the forecast. He read the signs, he read the moon, and he checked the positions of the moon, and heard it was down south or overhead, or what position it was in at the time of year, and set a stake up right here where we start planting today. He said, by the time this corn is tasseling, the corn we're planting today will be about 2 foot higher than the corn that we got through planting a week or 10 days ago. Of course, we kind of forgot about it, but it happened just like my dad said, kind of that corn tasseled out. The corn that we planted about 10 days later, it was on the new of the moon, he said. He said, I want you to know the difference. He said, it'd be 2 foot taller than the one we planted on the old of the moon. And you could stand off 100 yards from that field and see to the road where we started planting that corn. So that made me sit up and take notice a little bit. I kind of got interested in those signs. So I began to listen a little closer to his predictions. And he never would clean his barn out of manure and anything like that. But always spring of the year, we cleaned out the barns good and throwed it out on the poor land so it'd rich the ground. But he wouldn't do it on the new of the moon. He said, you throw that out there on the new of the moon, said it'll just lay there and dry up and the wind will blow it away. So it would. It actually seemed to anyway. It would have missed. So he's talking about building a fence. We used to build old rail fences. And what we call the worm, he never would lay the worm. That was the first bottom rail. He always put a rock under the corners where the rails hit the ground, or come close to the ground, to keep them off the ground so they wouldn't rot. And he wouldn't lay what you call a fence worm on the old of the moon. He said, you lay that rock on it down on the old of the moon. He said, it will sink in a year's time. Said that rock will sink plumb down flush with the top of it. He'll go right down in the ground. And your rail fence will be right down on the ground with it. He always laid his, what he called a fence worm on the near the moon. And I noticed, one day he said, I'll prove it to you. He set one rock out on the old of the moon. And then he set one side by side out on the new of the moon on the same ground. And it wasn't real hard ground. It wasn't real hard clay or nothing like that. But anyway, he said, you watch in a year's time, watch these two rocks and see what to do. And he was absolutely right. The rock was laid on the full of the moon. It kept sinking in the ground. And rock was laid on down there on the near of the moon, it seemed like if anything you got higher. So I watched his signs and I listened to his weather prophecy. He said, they always told me, he said the first thing he done of a morning when he got up, he went outside, he checked the wind direction and position of the moon if it was showing at that time of day. Early of the morning, and direction of the wind, and he was a terrible weather watcher. I remember one time in 1929 or 33, I guess it was, we had one of the worst droughts that I've ever been through, and it hadn't rained for months, and had dust storms out in Texas. And the dust was so thick here that you just barely could see the sun at midday. I can remember riding the old mules to the field and back after I'd been plowing. And I'd hit the leaves on the bushes with a stick Her hoe handle and the dust would just fly off of them. It settled from all the way from Texas and Oklahoma during the Dust Bowl. And he predicted, remember one day, Dad got up, we heard him talking to my mother. He said, well, this drought is fixing to come to end in less than 7 days from now. He said, we're going to have rain. Said, this drought is going to end. It didn't end like I thought it might, or usually it does, with a violent thunderstorm or some nature like that. It just clouded up one day, real still, and it wasn't hot or it wasn't real cold. It was just a nice time of the summer. And it just started sprinkling the rain, just getting a little harder. And it rained all day and all night, and the next morning it was still raining. And the drought was broken, just like he said. And he always told my mother, he said, as long as that new moon, it news way down south, just a little above the horizon, he said, if it don't come back north, when it falls, he said, it'll stay back there and we'll have dry weather as long as it does. And he said, this is the first indication that the moon has traveled north since the drought started. And he was absolutely right on that fact. Speaking about my dad, he was a fellow that was always thinking about little frivolous jokes. He got a kick out of telling them. He always, in the community down there, they used to have what they call these circuit riding preachers. These churches out in the country, they didn't have a regular preacher or wasn't able to afford one. So they had what they call a circuit preacher. He rode around of many churches in the neighborhood, and from Sunday to Sunday and from meeting to meeting, and most always their dads, well, when there was a church going on anywhere, they'd end up there with Dad for maybe a week sometimes, was holding a week meeting. He said about some preacher, yeah, of course I can't remember his name, he said he's preaching over there Clay Springs. There's an old log church over there. And I just barely can remember it. And I don't know where I believe I've been to church when I was a little boy there, but I just barely can remember. Anyway, in the back of the pulpit, they had big auger holes where they'd bored back in there with 1-inch augers back in those logs. And that's where the preacher, they didn't have a pulpit or anything. They just used that auger hole back there. They'd roll up their little sermons and put it back in that hole back there. And when they got ready to start their text, well, they'd reach back in there and get their text and start preaching on it. That's one Sunday he got up over there. He'd noticed the preacher after they got ready to start his little sermon. Well, the preacher, he kept ad-libbing, and he kept backing up and running his finger back in that there auger hole there. He wasn't trying to turn around and see what he had done. He just a feeling back there. Dad said every time he'd put his finger back in that where this sermon was, he kept pushing it back a little further, and he got to where he couldn't get hold of it at all. He finally talked a few minutes, and he told the congregation, he said, I'll tell you. He said, what I've done, he said, I've got a pretty good sermon back here in this auger hole, but he said, I just can't get it out. Dad, he believed in discipline, strong discipline, especially his children. I remember one time, just barely can't remember it. That's just how old I was. I guess I wasn't old enough to go to school. I was probably 6 years old. But one day, Me and Dad walked over to Ed Judd's General Store. It's about around 2 miles from home to Judd's Store. We walked over there. Of course, we usually stayed an hour or so. I thought it was one of the greatest things in the world to get over there and look around through the store and look at the candy and stuff that most little boys, that's interested in. While I was looking there at the counter, I looked over and there's a little pencil, about 2 inches long, what they used to call a penny pencil. And I was just a little intrigued about that pencil, and I thought, Dad and Mr. Judd were just talking, and I just picked that little pencil up, and I guess I put it in my pocket. I don't know what I'd done with it, but anyway, we went on home. In a little while, of course, I had to get that little pencil out, and I guess I was marking or something, and my dad, he seen me marking it, and he said, John said, what are you doing there? I said, this is the marking. He said, where did you get that pencil? Well, I said, I found it over there at the store. He said, where did you find it? And I said, well, I knew better than to tell him a story. I said, it was laid there by the counter where the candy was, And he said, young man, he said, we're going right back to the store right now. You're taking that pencil back. Said, that don't belong to you. And he got a little bit riled at me, and he cut me a little switch as we left. He walked back with me. That's about 2 miles. It's so... We'd walk a little while, and I got slowed down a little. He'd warp me with that little old switch on my legs. Boy, I'd hop and skip and get going right quick. And I went back over there, and Dad made me to march up to Mr. Judd and apologize for picking up that little old pencil. And Mr. Judd, he said, well, Mr. Lewis, said, I don't care for that pencil. Said, that little old pencil, I'd probably discard it. Said, let him have that. He can have that. And Dad said, no, he can't have that either. He said, that don't belong to him. So I had to return that pencil just to go all the way back. I walked 2 miles there and 2 miles back to get to apologize for picking up that pencil. And that taught me a lesson until today that you don't want to pick up anything that don't belong to you. My dad, he was strict. He was honest. But he had a temper. He'd give me a shellacking just about every day. He told me later on these years, he said, son, he said, I've whipped you more than all the other 11 children put together. Tears kind of come in his eyes. He's sort of apologetic about it. I said, Dad, I said, if that's bothering you, I said, don't you worry 1 minute. I said, if I deserved every one of them, every lick that I got and a lot I didn't get, I said, don't you worry a minute about it. So that kind of eased his mind. But I remember one time me and Dad were going to Mr. Judd's store on another occasion. It was in the winter time. That's before they even had any gravel or anything on the roads. They were just pure red mud, and especially in the winter time, it was just almost impassable. People either went on horseback, buggy, wagon, and that was about the mode of transportation in those days. That was before the airplane become anything like common in the States. There was a few around, but excuse me. But they wasn't plentiful at all. We met Dr. Moore. I guess it was Dr. Moore, old Dr. Moore. Best I remember is he was a doctor. He'd come all the way out of Allgood at that time. He's on a big red sorrel horse. I remember they had leggings or something of that nature on their legs, you like they wore back then. And it was a snow on the ground. It just melted about half. And it was a big snow, best I remember. And there was a lot of water, a lot of mud, and a lot of slush. And it was cold. It wasn't really that warm, but it's cold and warm enough it had been melting and it's slushy and muddy. And he was just muddy, the doctor was, of course, his stirrups on up to his waist almost, where the old horse had sloshed through mud and throwed it up on him. Of course, we almost had to stop when we met the old man, me and Dad did, and Dad spoke to him, and he realized who it was. He said, "How are you, Dr. Boyer?" He said, "I'm fine." And he talked about the weather for a moment, and Dad said, "Well," said, it's a nice day overhead." And the doctor, he spurred his old horse, and he went off, and he said, "Yes, but who in the hell can travel overhead?" Uncle George Bilbrey used to live out the road from us. Old man, he was wasn't a harm in the world, and the old fella, he was one of the best fellas that I ever seen. He was just so good to us kids there at home. He would come out to home in the morning just to see us kids get out of bed. He told Dad one morning, he said, "I'd just like to come out here and see these young'uns get out of bed and see how active they are." The old fella, he's probably in his 60s. I thought he was 100-year-old probably then when I was just a kid. But anyway, he would walk out to the house. It was about 200 yards, I guess, from where we lived to his house. But he would walk out there in these cold mornings. I remember it was so cold, we couldn't hardly jump out of bed and get to the fireplace quick enough to get our clothes on without freezing. Old Uncle George, he never had a coat. If he ever did, I never seen him wear one. He'd come out there every morning. He always had his shirt unbuttoned about 3 buttons down, and it throwed back wide open. But he's kind of heavy set, old fella. And he'd come out every morning like that, just hot or cold. I remember going to school. I'd walk by there. One particular morning, it was about 7 or 8 inches of snow. It was cold. I walked to school that day, of course. And come back home, my door that morning as I went to school, that front door was wide open. It didn't have but one window, and they had a shutter over it there by the fireplace. The only light they could get was from that front door. So they kept it open just about the year round. Now, that didn't make no difference just as long as it wasn't a storm and that door was open. Of course, I come back that afternoon, it was still open, and I was just cold. And I'd stopped Kate out there. And I stopped. I thought, "I'll just go in and see how the old people are." Uncle George and Aunt Ellie, they was living there. And of course, Clayton, he lived there, but I don't remember seeing him around that particular time. But I went inside, and of course, coming in out of the snow into the dark room, it didn't have no light. And Aunt Ellie, she was sitting on one side of the fireplace, and Uncle George on the others. They might have been a good handful of fire coals in the fireplace, and that was about it. They'd been burning a big log. A rail, it was about 4 foot long, too long to go in the fireplace. They just feeding it a little at a time in there, and it burnt up. I remember Aunt Ellie, she took her old stone pipe, or cob pipe, I guess it was stone, because she dipped the pipe and then ashes down there and get a little fire, and she'd sit there and puff that old strong tobacco. I can remember smelling that tobacco out at home late of the evening. You could smell it for 2 miles, that smoke. But how in the world those old folks kept getting new money and all that, I'll never be able to tell. But I remember one time we was planting corn just above Uncle George's house there. And he come up there, we sat down to rest one day, me and Daw and Deloy and Dad. I guess Jess and Frank and the rest of them had left home, and we's the younger one. Anyway, we was resting up on the hill, and here come Uncle George. He wanted to sit down there with us. He and my dad started talking. Of course, me and Daw and Deloy, we got to playing and the wrestling and the carrying on. And Uncle George, he just, oh, he just pleased that old man. He sat there and watched us. And of course, Dad hollered at us every once in a while to behave herself or something like that. But Uncle George, he said, go and let him alone. He said, I'll tell you what. He said, I'll tell you what, Golden. He said, sometimes I wished I'd raised me some ladens. That was recorded about 2 to 3 years ago. I was here by myself one Sunday afternoon, just kind of going back through my mind and the memories. And I thought someday I might finish up the tape. Just for the fun of it. It may not be interested much to nobody, but I've had a lot of requests to kind of finish it out. I don't know a lot of tales to tell, except on my own lifetime. I've lived a life of, I guess it's pretty well filled with just about a little of everything. I was into a little meanness. I was sort of mischievous. And I done a lot of things like every boy did, I guess. Those things that I shouldn't have done, but I thought at the time it was what I ought to do, but I guess it turned out it wasn't so good after all. So I just thought maybe, I don't know whether I'll do anything today or not, but I guess I'll just kind of wait till the notion hits me. Maybe some of these days I'll try to finish this thing up. This is December the 26th, 2001. Just the next day after Christmas. I'm here all by myself. And just thought I might record just a little of my lifetime. Start back when I was a young man. I was about 15, 16 years old, I guess. There's a neighbor lived about 2 miles from where I did. And they had a little daughter over there that was named Lucille. I don't know just where I met her and what the occasion was, but I remember the first time that I seen her that was the cutest little girl that I'd ever run across. From that on, it's kind of, I claimed her as my girlfriend until I got big enough to go out with a girl, I guess. I wasn't old enough to date when I first met her, I don't think. But anyway, we got married, I guess it's in August in 1937. We raised 6 children. I don't know how I got them through, but I did. But I really had a tough time of it. Back in, during the time that I was raising my family, the times were really hard. The jobs were scarce. There wasn't any jobs here in Overton County to speak of at all. Only thing there was here that had any employment at all was a sawmill or state highway or county highway, department one, and if you were lucky enough to get on one of those, well, you might have had a chance. But anyway, when I got old enough to get a job, I went to Nashville, and Lonzie, he gave me a job down there with the state, or got me a job with the state highway down there at the rock crusher. I worked there for a dollar and a dime a day for all summer. Of course, I stayed there with Lonzie. He didn't charge me any board. I just stayed there free. I don't know how he put up with me. Anyway, I saved all that money that I made, which wasn't much. You can imagine a dollar and a dime a day. But I got enough money, I went to Detroit. I went to Detroit and got me a job there. Frankie worked at Burton Dixie Corporation. And Jess, I think he worked there at that time too. So I got a job there. I'm making 37 and a half cents an hour, and I thought, boy, I'll get rich here. I worked there a few years, and went up to Burkhart Corporation, another place similar to the one I'd been working at, and they made the same type of automobile things that they made at Burton Dixie, so we got a job there and worked there for a while. Of course, he got laid off, and I'd come home, and during that time I was working up there, me and Lucille got married, and I'd come down here and get laid off in the fall of the year a lot of times. I'd come down here and we'd stayed at Bob's and Cumis, and I would bird hunt. Me and Bob, we'd winter time. He was a terrible hunter and a fisherman, and he enjoyed it as well as I did. We almost lost a crop of fishing one year because we just stayed on the creek nearly all the time. But anyway, I raised a family, finally got them up on their own. I'm proud of them. It didn't bring shame upon none of us. That's one thing I was proud of. I call good boys and girls. But I guess I've been raised in the last few years. I'd had a lot more to worry about, the way the drugs and everything is rampant and anymore. I'm glad I got my children up over that before the drug area come along so bad. Anyway, I'm going to talk about their mother, Lucille. She thought a lot of her children, her whole life with her children, her grandchildren. She never really, when she died, it was a great loss to me. I didn't think I'd ever get over it, and really hadn't, never will, but I was lucky. I married another woman that's, I couldn't have found a better one than she is. I've been awful lucky. And I just can't go too much further than that, so I'm going to stop right now. I have a few episodes in my life that I'm really not too proud of. I've had a lot of requests for a tale that I told a lot of times about me and a neighbor boy over in the country there, a little neighbor to me. Me and him was big buddies. We growed up together. We done about everything together. We did a lot of meanness together. Drunk a lot of old whiskey together. That's the things that we ought to have been put in jail for. I've had a lot of requests to finish telling this story. I'm not too proud of it, but one time being the boy that I was talking about, his name was Estill Lankford. He had a brother named Vestal. Me and Jess and Vestal and Estill, we'd been a fishing one night. We walked all the way from home, from Dad's down there, to Spring Creek, which is a mile and a half or farther, maybe 2 miles. We fished till about 9 o'clock that night. We come on back home. Of course, we was tired. We'd been working all day, probably. If you're on the farm, you always. Dad's house and Clinny Holloway's house there, kind of in a road bed, but there's big flat rocks there where you. We sat down on that and we began to talk, and Estill, of course, we drank a little. And And Estelle said, "I wish we had a drink of whiskey." And I said, "Well, I do too, but I don't have any." He said, "Why don't we go down to Andy's and get us a drink?" Andy Green was a bootlegger, lived down in the country about at least 3 miles down there, maybe farther. I just about four, I'd imagine. And I said, "It's an awful far walk down there just for a little drink of whiskey. Besides, I ain't got no money to buy anything with, have you?" And he said, "No, I ain't got no money." And I said, "Well, there won't be no needing going to get any, because we can't buy it on the credit." And we sat there a few minutes, and he decided, I'll tell you what. I said, "My mother, she's got some glass jars where she canned fruit, and she'd take them and empty them, and she'd take them down to the spring house. She'd wash them up and set them back down there in the spring house till next year she got ready to use them again." Well, of course, she'd emptied quite a few of them. I said, "We could get those cans and swap that for whiskey if we could get there." So he said, "Oh, that would work." Said Andy, he always wants the fruit jars in his bootlegging business. He said, "He needs them." I said, "Well, I had a little thin overcoat we wore mostly just to sit down on the bank of the river on to have something to sit on so it wouldn't be on the damp ground. But anyway, I had that little overcoat along, and we went out to the barn, we talked about going to the barn and getting Dad's old mule. And Estelle, he said, "Nah," he said, "Mr. Lewis, too good." He said, "I wouldn't want to do him like that." Said, and we went and got those cans. We wrapped them up in that overcoat. I don't know. I guess we had 10 or 12. I don't know how many we had. And all I could carry in that overcoat, tied the sleeves together and kind of like it. And it was dark as it could be. Down the moon had done gone over the hill, but it's dark there in that horse lot. And Clitty had a little old dog up there. He always barked at the slightest noise. I don't know why in the world that dog didn't bark at us that night, but he didn't. Yep, a time. He opened the gate, and he went in there and grabbed a bridle off the barn gate there. And he opened the door, stable door, that old mule just going around and around, you know. Clinty claimed the old mule wouldn't let you ride him at all. And I told Estelle, I said, "You can't ride that old mule. He'll throw you," Clinton said. Estelle said, "Oh, why, we'll ride him." He went in there and bridled that old mule and whipped him around. That old mule, he stuck his head out the door and Estelle put the bridle on him. He come leading him out the gate. And I thought, sure, boy, Clinty Holloway will shoot us for sure. I expect that little dog to bark in a minute. But he never did. So we didn't go on up by the house. We come back down toward Dad's and went around down another road away from Clinty's house so we wouldn't have to pass it. We got down there and Estelle got on that old mule, and he kind of hopped and skipped around like he didn't like for him to be on his back at all. So he spurred him around there a little bit, and then he drove up to me and said, "Here, get on." And I handed him them cans of, I had in that overcoat. I jumped up behind him on that old mule, and that old mule, he didn't buck or anything. He just kind of squatted down. I just slid back off of him. He didn't much want to let me back on him. That's when he handed me those cans back, and he said, "Well, just wait a minute." He said, "You just be walking on down." Said, "I'll." He took off on that old mule just as hard as he could go down the holler there. He went plumb out of here, and that mule just running just hard as he could. Directly I heard him coming back, running the same way, and he got back up there to us, that old mule. He was just a snorting and a breathing hard. He said, "Now get on to see if the old son of a gun will be still." Well, got on the old mule. He didn't show a trick then. So we rode him on down to Andy's. We got there about, I guess, around midnight. And before we got there, Estelle said, "Now, Andy, he'll always offer you to drink a whiskey." He said, "Drink all you can." We went out there and, of course, got Andy out of bed. Had a big high porch along the front of the house. Went full length of the house, the porch did. And he lit his lantern, he went out to the barn, got a 5-gallon jug. It was about half full of whiskey. It wasn't one of these, it was a big slim 5-gallon jug. I bet it was a foot and a half tall, slim. It was about half full of whiskey. Of course, he come bringing that back out there and set his lantern down on the front porch there and balanced that whiskey jug over his knee. And he was just aiming pour just about 2/3 of a quart of whiskey in one of the containers we had. That's all he was aiming to give us for them cans. Estill said, "Oh, fill it on up, and you." "Oh," he said, "I can't do that. That's more than it's worth now." But while he was doing that, Estill, he slipped in behind him, and while he had that jug balanced over his knee, Estill, he's sitting right behind him, he put his hand in there, the jug, so when they had started to let the jug back down, he had it about as poured as much in the can as he thought we needed. He started to let it back down, but Estill had his hand in behind it, and he didn't know it. Of course, Estill just kept the pressure on it. He run the jug over with whiskey. And he said, "Dive in," said, "look what you're doing now." Estill grabbed it. He said, "That's all right," said, "I'll drink it so it won't run over." We drank almost enough to get drunk there. Well, we almost forgot about the old mule, but we quit riding him. He just followed us along. And we walked on down the foot of the hill from Andy's house and come on back. I smoked quite a bit. I smoked all the time, but Estill, he didn't smoke. Of course, I had to roll me a cigarette, and not knowing I didn't have a match, of course, I got rolled and didn't have no match. And I said, "Boy, I'd like to have," I asked him if he had one. He said, "No, I don't smoke. I don't never carry any matches." Oh, he said, "Wait a minute, we'll go over here." Said, "Uncle Louis Bilber lives right out here." Said, we'll get some matches from him." It's getting along to 1 or 2 o'clock in the morning. I said, "Well, we better not bother that old man." "Oh," he said, "he don't care." He said, "he's used to it." He said, "he'll take a drink of whiskey if you'll offer it to him." Well, we rode up to the old man's house, and Estill hollered at him. Here he come. Had a boardwalk out from the porch right out to a paling fence to the gate. I remember the old man got up. He's in his 70s. And he had on these long white drawers like these old people used to wear. It's the summertime. He come strolling out through there. And Estill said, "Uncle Louis," said, "we want to smoke here and don't have no fire." I said, "Have you got any matches? We'd like to have fire." He said, "Dip in, boys." He said, "there ain't a match on the place." But he said, "I'll tell you what." He said, "I've got a little fire. I always keep a little fire in the fireplace nearly all the time." He said, "I think there's some in there. I'll go." And the old man went in there and he took his little old shovel. He brought me a coal of fire out there to light my cigarette with. We offered him a drink of whiskey, and he took it. Oh, he said, "that was good." So we let the old man go back to bed. We come on back home. Of course, it was about 3 or 4 o'clock in the morning time we got back home. Like I said, we didn't ride the old mule anymore. We just walking along and singing and acting a fool and having a big time. The old mule, every time we'd stop, he'd stop right with us. We come on back down, right down McClenny's house. We just walked and led the old mule back in the stable, pulled the bridle off of him, put him inside, went on to the house. It was about 2 years later that Estill, he said, "I'm going to tell Mr. Louis about that. Him dad always had a big laugh." And I said, "I don't know whether you ought to or not." "Yeah," he said, "that's tell him." He told Dad about it. Dad, he got a big laugh at it, but he said, "I tell you what, you boys better not let Clinty Holloway find out what you've done." Said, he'll take you into court today over that. We had a big laugh about that. That's a few things that I'd done, wasn't too proud of, but I thought we was having fun at that time. Anyway, there's a lot of episodes in my life that I've not too proud of, but I had a little fun. It wasn't too bad. I never done nothing that's really detrimental to anybody trying to remember of. You ever heard me talk about Uncle George Bibbers? The old fella that lived out there close to Dad when I was a boy. Where he had a son named Clayton. Old Clayton, he was a funny fella. He's dry humor, but he could really tell you some good ones. I remember one time me and him was up waiting on the mail. We had to walk up there to where Doyle's built a house now. There wasn't no houses there at end at all. There's a road to live. That's what we called a big road. That's where the mailboxes were. And Clayton, that was during the Depression. Nobody had any money or anything. Clayton, he'd been cutting a lot of wood. He owned some property right up there next to the road, and he cut a lot of stove wood. And he'd cut wood and stacked it up there along the road, and just an awful nice ricks of wood, you know. And we were up there in the mailbox one day. It had been there for a long time. That wood had. Nobody had touched it. No, he hadn't sold anything, done nothing. And one day, man, Clayton, he's up there with me. We sitting there waiting for the mail. And I said, Clayton, I said, you're not doing too much good about selling your wood, are you? He said, no. He said, I tell you what, he said, if I was to die and go to hell with a chunk of ice that I got there, there's somebody, everybody'd have a piece, I couldn't even give it away. He told me about how broke he was one time. He said, if a cross tie is selling for a penny a piece, he said, I couldn't even afford a toothpick off of it. I remember one time Clayton, he liked to drink. He liked the whiskey. He wouldn't get out and get drunk in public, hardly at all for that matter, but he'd like to get him a half a gallon of whiskey and he'd go home and stay in bed till he drank that up. But on the way home from the bootleggers, he usually got drunk before he got home with it. I remember one time him and Marion Webb, they went out to the store out there at Hardy's Chapel. There's a little grocery store out there. And Marion, he liked to drink too. And they went out there one, it was a rainy weather in the winter time, winter-like. I was a boy, there's some big walnut trees down there next to the road. I was sitting down there cracking and eating some walnuts one day, and it'd been raining, cool, foggy, and damp, muddy. And I kept hearing something around the bend of the road there. There's a little curve right there that I could make. I couldn't see around where I was sitting and cracking and eating those walnuts right next to the road. And I kept hearing something around. I thought, well, somebody's coming, but they never would. It seemed to get around that curve. I kept waiting and wondering what it was. I knowed I was hearing something. It wasn't making a lot of noise, but I knowed there's something around that curve. Well, Clayton, he finally made it. He was so drunk, he'd walk about 4 or 5 steps forward, and then he'd fall about 4 or 5 steps backwards on his back. He was muddy and dirty from head to toe, and he just glass-eyed. He couldn't see nothing. He'd get up here, he'd walk a while, he'd fall a while. I sat there and watched him. He walked 10 foot of me. He didn't even see me. He wasn't there looking at me. I looked, he had something in his hand. I thought, well, what in the world is it? And I looked at it and had a little old bale out of a bucket. Now, come to find out what it was, he'd bought him some groceries, and he had a little 4 or 5 pound lard bucket that used to come in. That lard come in little buckets like that. He'd had that in his hand. Of course, the bale had come loose from the bucket. He'd lost all of his groceries and his bucket of grease, too. He finally went on home, of course. Come to find out the next day, somebody come along, followed him, married, and they picked up groceries all the way from Marty's Chapel to Clayton and Marvin to Iowa. Oh, boy, what a mess he was.